I'm Christopher Lydon in New Delhi with the master psychologist of India, colonial India, post-colonial India, modern and global India, Ashish Nandi. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude in India this midsummer of 2010. Ashish Nandi, let me ask, at a moment when the whole world, including Barack Obama, coming in November, wants to know what makes India tick, how do you, Ashish Nandi, describe Indianness?
I will define it, very proudly define it, as a culture so rich in its diversity that all possibilities are represented here as vectors. They may be released or they may not, never come into play, but at potentialities they exist.
Give some examples. And how different from other countries in the world?
For instance, Malcolm Muggeridge once said that Indians are the only surviving English in the world. I would go further. I think only in India you will find perhaps Victorian England surviving in pockets so confidently that you can consider that museumized form as the last remaining vestige of Victorian England. So it is not only England which survives here, but also the diversities within England to some extent. You can find in India many of the esoteric dissenting strains surviving better than they had survived in England. I mean, one of India's prime ministers was known for his urine therapy. He used to drink his own urine, a glass of it every morning, almost as an elixir of life. Now, this was not any part of any traditional Indian healing system. It came into India from 19th century Britain.
Other examples?
The survival of Agatha Christie and P.G. Wodehouse as novelists. England has forgotten them more or less. They survive here as the ultimate standards of detective novels and comic novels. There are people here who can give you street directions in London without ever being in London.
From reading Sherlock Holmes, you mean?
I knew one such person. Yes, not only Sherlock Holmes, Victorian novels. Dickens, Thackeray. So they knew all about London, even the streets.
Go on about Indianness and its in its present state, here on the verge of global power and maybe big prosperity. What's happening to that identity that you know so well?
It is becoming more and more recessive. Partly it's a natural process of time, I guess. But partly also the Indian vision of a good society, at least in the middle class, is changing. It is no longer Edwardian England, or if you want to put it broadly, pre-war England or Europe. It's becoming United States. Oscar Wilde once said that the good Englishmen, when they die, go to Paris. The good Indian, when they die, used to go to London and Paris, perhaps to Moscow also. But now they go to New York.
Really? Ashish Nandi, I've read your wonderful little book, Intimate Enemies, and I associate you maybe forever with this notion that between the colonial power and the colony, there is not only a very complex tension, but in the end, in this case, the colonized grew and prevailed and recovered, and the colonizer sort of wore itself out. Do I get it right?
Yes, perhaps. You are not far from what I tried to convey.
Explain the whole idea of intimate enemies.
I think it takes... I was very interested in finding out what happens to the colonizers. Because England, after everything said, was a small country. India was huge. And my suspicion is these many of the pathologies we identify with Imperial Britain became a part of social reality in Britain, partly because of the burden of the colonies they had to carry with them. I mean, you cannot call another country effeminate or childlike or senile and decrepit without changing the norms within your own society, how you treat women, children, and the elderly. And this language of the body was central to colonialism all over the world. China and India were simultaneously seen as half savage, half child. The cultural hierarchy came when the utilitarians began to take an interest in India and found it in it what they thought to be a clean slate on which to write their project of civilizing mission. And we have never quite got out of it. After the end of colonialism, the Indian middle class and ruling elite have picked up the civilizing mission. They have the same attitude towards large parts of the society which in the second phase of colonial rule the British had towards Indians.
This is where the intimate enemies come in.
I am not surprised when many Indians talk of colonialism as a necessary stage in India's progress, somewhat in the manner in which Karl Marx talked about it, that despite all the cruelties, all the bloodshed, the back of tradition was being broken and a new society will emerge from it. It has not happened in India, it didn't happen in Soviet Union or Maoist China. The Chinese have gone back to Confucius, and even the Chinese Communist Party is now talking of Confucius. And Mao has become a minor deity who saves you from traffic accidents, and the drivers hang his Mao charms in their car as a protection. I think these civilizations know how to take care of these grand visions of social engineering.
So what was the process in India of transformation by colonial outsiders?
Well, the process was heavily dependent on categories and concepts. They began to look at themselves the way the colonizing societies looked at themselves, began to look at parts of the society as redundant, obsolete, and disposable. Exactly as the way in United States, in North and South America, for example, the conquerors looked at the indigenous people. That was the world's most successful genocide that everybody knows. It is no accident, I think, that all these 19th century social theories which talked of radical social engineering ultimately ended up in some form of genocide or other, whether it's in Nazi Germany or in Soviet Union or in China. The German treatment of the Hereres in Africa was where they honed their skills. Their fault was that they brought that system home into Europe, and Europe confronted what has been going on in the colonies for centuries. It is true that they took it to its logical conclusion, and the Nazi innovations in this kind of a assembly line killings. But nonetheless, what they showed was this, that ultimately what others can do to you, you can also do to your own kind, to become like the others who have dominated you. The hidden message in colonialism and the kind of process of industrialization and development you see in many parts of the world is the same. It is as if North America and West Europe is telling to Asia, Africa, and Latin America, South America, that you do to your people what we have done to ours, to become like us. And they have been very willing learners in that respect. They are very, very obedient students they have been. And I do see in a country after country in Asia, Africa, South America, that the process of development also goes with despotism, shrinkage of, if you like to call it, human rights, suspension of civil liberties, and total control. Many Indians have now begun to look at this kind of solutions as appropriate for the development of India to match China's growth rate. They feel almost deprived that they don't have a Chinese-style regime which will hasten the process of development by removing all obstacles, all debates from the public sphere. Many of the environmentalists and those who protest against the uprooting and displacement and dispossession of our tribal populations are accused of being traitors. And there you see the colonial mantle is now worn by the local native regime, so to speak, who are willing to do to their citizens what at one time they accused the colonial powers of doing to the society as a whole.
What's the worst of it?
Well, I think the worst of it is this, that in a country like India, it will probably condemn 10 to 15% of the people to not only breakdown of traditional life support systems, creating a new class of floating proletariat, which will move from one urban slum to another looking for work, destruction of little cultures all over India and whatever goes with it, healing traditions, forms of agronomy, styles of music, cuisine. I mean, it is very clear that a large section of Indian middle class today would welcome the death of these tribal communities. They will like them to remain there as symbolic presences. They would like to retain their music and their cuisine, perhaps some of the art forms, provided they obligingly die out and these products associated with their culture can be protected in museums. They don't like to see them as thriving, functioning communities. India is so successful in economically speaking, if we look, judge by growth rates, I think it can easily make sure that some of these small communities survive. Everybody doesn't have to come within the ambit of development. Every village doesn't have to opt for urbanization. They are fairly autonomous already. They need a little bit of protection so that they can live in their own style. India is a society where diversity of culture is ensured by the fact that it has allowed people to live at different centuries throughout the centuries. If somebody wants to live in 22nd century, he can do so. And if some people want to live in the 17th century, they can also do so. India has something like 1500 languages, many of them enumerated out of existence virtually because they are seen as dialect or spoken by very few people. Nobody cares if they die or live.
Like the tigers.
Like tigers. India allowed a diversity of religions too. There are communities where everybody is simultaneously a Hindu, a Christian, and also has a tribal religion. I think that days are numbered. Or at least it seems so at the moment. When we talk of globalization, we forget that along with globalization of financial capital, lifestyles, religions and cultures too are getting globalized. So increasingly, the global Muslims look like one community. And many states will be happy with that. That makes management easy. And this is happening with many communities. There is a kind of aggregation of communities. Basically, Indian religions were local. So when you talk of 330 million gods and goddesses in Hinduism,
how many?
330 million is the mythic figure. which actually means that no well-educated theologian of Hinduism will ever be able to count them all. That's the idea. They are innumerable.
Ashish Nandi, Barack Obama will come to India in November. Imagine that he asked you to tell him about this country, its hopes, its dreams, its fears, the history that it carries in its head, its imagination about a new century. What would you tell him?
I would say that this is, he should be wise not to take the Indian middle class as the be-all and end-all of India. The first principle is this, that he must take into account how the majority of Indians think about public life and their future in politics, global politics as well as Indian politics.
What do they think?
At this point of time, the Indians are looking for a more human and compassionate regime. Indians are not accustomed to a heavily impersonal government which works like a well-oiled machine, which gives them a high growth rate but cannot take care of the more obscene forms of poverty and destitution they see around them. Actually, if you look at it, poverty is not a problem in India. Many sectors of Indians have lived in poverty for a long time, and their needs are little, they want also very little. That is why most surveys show that most Indians are reasonably happy with their economic state, though a large section of Indians live in poverty. I think our problem is not so much poverty, but destitution. What you might call absolute poverty, where you, if you don't have the money, you starve to death. You don't starve to death in a tribal society if you do not have money. Only if the whole community does not have money, then you starve to death. And I suspect that instead of trying to pull people above the poverty line, if we could directly attack this kind of destitution, we shall go farther.
How would you attack it?
Well, by providing direct support to the impoverished families. Instead of going through a labyrinthian process of what we call now trickle-down effort. So you allow wealth to be generated so that ultimately it will trickle down. By the time it trickles down, the bottom 10% of population will perhaps die. So you will eliminate the poverty, but by eliminating the poor, actually. And this has happened in many countries, and I don't want this to happen in the case of India. And I don't think Obama can do anything about that, but Obama can at least be aware of the fact that the Indians he will interact with, the Indians he will see, are not the whole of India. They are a small minority.
Interesting. And Barack Obama is a hugely attractive human being, and he has a flair for the dramatic gesture. Can you imagine him signaling his awareness, his sympathy, his support for that vast mass of non-high-tech India?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people in the outside world, and a lot of India, people in India too, recognize the other India exists. They celebrate it. But when it comes to political decision-making and public policy, somehow they kind of think that that is outside the ken of normal politics. And if you ask me, the Indian people have never failed Indian democracy. They only seem to fail their state, which expects them to be another kind of people. The state will be delighted if they could elect Indian people every 5 years also. They are never happy with the Indian people as they are. A compassionate and human society is not impossible in India, because somehow or other it is tacitly accepted by all sections of Indian society that it would have been better that way. I think it is certainly possible to fight for it, and everything said, an open society gives you the scope to do so. But these battles are partly delegitimized by, not ignored, but delegitimized by new kinds of power structure which India Indians are not accustomed to handle. Like, for example, Indians never had very large Indian multinational corporations. They never had this plethora of billionaires who stride the Indian public life now in such flamboyant manner, pontificating about everything. Indians have been used to this kind of heavy media exposure. They have not still developed the kind of skepticism which American public often have about American television, because they have been seeing television for over 60 years, and it was an open television. Anybody could run it. Indians are seeing it only for the last 15 years or so. So this kind of bombarding by media, their judgments are too much influenced by the media. The newspapers are also trying to imitate the television channels now and becoming entertainment dailies rather than newspapers. So certain things are so new to India, they don't know, the management of it is not. So it looks as if this is all of India. Information technology, this proliferation of engineers of all kinds, a technical education of all kind, large number of malls, Singapore style, that you see in the large Indian cities.
Yes.
The fashion parades, Bollywood, these seem to be the new India. It is not the new India. New India are those who embarrass you by scratching their backs with their forks while sitting in the parliament. That's the new India, because you don't like to recognize them as new Indians, because they're new to power, new to the urbanity to which you are accustomed.
Yes.
New to the positions of power. So to me, even that embarrassment which the middle class feels about this kind of people, the crude, slightly vulgar, rustic
hillbillies
who are coming closer to power, represent something of new India, because they have expanded political participation and released new energies from the bottom of the society. New kinds of political leaders will emerge from them. If not from them, at least from their children or grandchildren. This is a price you pay for democracy and an open society. So the challenge is not to close up the society and hand over initiative only to the technocrats. Challenge is how to keep political participation going. How not to yield ground only to the technocrats, but allow greater democratic participation and listen to the voice of the people.
Would you explain to me something? A woman aspiring to needlework in Ramanagar told us the other day that her favorite politician in all of India was Mayawati, chief minister in Uttar Pradesh, who other people say is terribly corrupt. Explain that. What is the charm of Mayawati?
Because she is an iconic presence for many women who come from sections which have not been exposed to modern India for a long time. She is the one who has gatecrashed into the Premier League without being apologetic about her preferences, likes and dislikes, and her lifestyle, and even about her corruption. Mayawati is not only corrupt, she's also despotic. She's authoritarian person and anti-democratic when it comes to her own party. But she does remain, nonetheless, a beacon of hope for many at the bottom of the society. And that's also not a small achievement. The modern Indian project was a civilizing mission, and they have been as imperious towards the rest of India as the Brits were towards all India Indians.
Come back to Barack Obama on precisely that point. He has at least a mythic memory of his grandfather in Kenya being called boy by the Brits, being reduced to a lowly servant. And it drove his father to America, and it produced Barack Obama in Hawaii and the man we know today. How might Barack Obama in India address the history of colonialism and the recovery from it?
I think by, if not giving up, at least by showing some robust skepticism to America's civilizing mission in the world. Because the American civilizing mission is, in one sense, a byproduct of British colonialism. Because that's the enemy they fought. And that's the model they partly took over. The whole European vision of a good society itself needs rethinking. That's not the job of one generation. That's the job of the next three generations.
Do you see a possibility of these two huge, complex cultures and countries working together in the 21st century?
I mean, I do, because both are open societies. And even if other countries democratize, it will take them a long time to become as open as these two countries are. I think in the future, these two countries might learn more from those strains of dissent which have been delegitimized, marginalized, or shelved as impractical, romantic, and anti-political. Because I think in both countries there is now a sizable proportion of population who look beyond the 19th century idea of industrialism, not industrialization, but industrialism, the 19th century idea of international politics as a snake pit and as a dog-eat-dog world. And I personally suspect that perhaps they can collaborate by new kinds of international covenants which go far beyond the existing ones in areas like environment, demilitarization of society, let me put it that way, perhaps even also lessening of consumption of the super rich.
Can you imagine a specific project with a name on it? The Indian American Project X.
How to measure a country's progress without referring to growth rate and expansion of an enrichment of one's armory.
Spiritual well-being. There's the assignment.
Spirituality has an odd ring in a country like India because there is too much of spirituality attributed to India. So many Indians are suspicious of anything which even vaguely smacks of spirituality. America is much more a hard materialist country, so their spirituality has a different kind of status. It may be dismissed by many, but it still also has, spirituality does not seem like a term of abuse. Here it does.
India seems to be tired of it, but Americans are still dying to eat, love, pray.
Yes, a lot of Americans come here for that, and many Indian gurus survive on their American disciples.
Ashish Nandi, where does India look beyond the West for inspiration or for a guidance, for a compass in the 21st century?
I don't think it looks beyond the West, and to me it's a great tragedy.
Interesting.
I consider countries like China, South Africa, Pakistan as very important to India, not in the sense in which politicians say, but as countries from where you can bring intellectuals, thinkers, writers to India and open up conversations and dialogues with them. If you would ask me, I think one of the great handicaps which the Indian political class suffers from is this, that they have this peculiar idea that you do not only talk with your enemies, you don't even read them and don't even think of them. In United States today, if you write the word Islam or Muslims on the back of your visiting card and give it to a foundation, that is good enough for them to support a project of yours.
It's good for Grant.
Good for Grants. Here is just the reverse. Just the reverse. There is some scope for studying what Indians see as enemy countries if that does not involve scholars from those countries. And if you, of course, talk of some of the activists from those countries, people who are hostile to India, and if you want to bring them and have open a conversation with them to find out why they are hostile, our bureaucracy will throw an apoplectic fit.
Do you not have visiting professors from China at Indian universities?
No. Some visitors sometimes, but not really no visiting professors. That would be quite unthinkable for Indians. It's a great pity, because these are very live societies, and many of the people there are fighting the same battles as Indians are fighting in their own country. You have something to learn from them. And even when they are hostile to India, that hostility also has arisen. And it is better to know their perspective, the reasons why they are hostile, and look deeper into the causes of that hostility than glibly presume that they are hostile just because they are ungodly and evil.
Yeah. Ashish Nandi, it is a joy to meet finally the great sage of Delhi. I've been looking forward to this for a long time, and it's been a wonderful afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us on Open Source. We hope to do this again.
I enjoyed it too, and I thank you too.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.